By the way, be very careful. There's an outbreak of E. coli in 8 states. It has left at least one person dead, 50 others sick, eating bagged fresh spinach. The death occurred in Wisconsin, where 20 other people were sickened. Now, the outbreak has sickened others. Here are the states, the other states. Wisconsin, of course, Connecticut, Idaho, Indiana, Michigan, New Mexico, Oregon, and Utah. They do not know the source of the outbreak. So if you bought a fresh bag of fresh spinach and you live in these states, don't eat it. Take it back to the store that you bought it from. My, my, my. In a moment, we are going to be talking with one of the world-renowned experts on UFO investigations, Philip Mantle. We're going live to the United Kingdom in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Philip Mantle, the former director of investigations for the British UFO Research Association, is the Mutual UFO Network's representative for England and is an honorary member of the Research Institute on Anomalous Phenomena in the Ukraine. Philip Mantle has published one book entitled Without Consent, A Study of UFO Abductions in the UK, which he co-authored with Carl Nagaitis. He is an international lecturer on the subject of UFOs and has also worked for a variety of television and radio companies around the world. My pleasure to introduce tonight Philip Mantle to Coast to Coast. Hi, Philip. How are you?
Good evening. I'm fine. Thank you.
God, it's so good to talk with you, Philip. We've heard so much about you over the years and your investigation. How did Philip Mantle get involved in this?
Well, I've always been interested. I mean, I think back as far as I can as a young boy, I was always interested in certainly the space race at the time, but also the paranormal. And they tended to sort of run on parallel lines. You know, I was the young boy when we would stand up in class, talk about our pet subject. It wasn't my rabbit or, you know, soccer. Mine was ghosts and poltergeists and flying saucers. And then in the late 1970s, I was also an amateur astronomer, and I was with a friend in the west of England using an observatory. And we read a little book, and it mentioned UFOs, which we didn't know a lot about, but there was a place nearby called Warminster in Wiltshire, where apparently there was a lot of sightings. So, hey, presto, we took a trip, stood on the hillside, and we saw these strange lights one evening. And that sparked the interest even more intensely. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Well, I got to tell you, your work with this book, Mysterious Sky, Soviet UFO Phenomena, is fascinating, primarily because to me, Philip, not a lot of information came out of the Soviet Union, of course, during the Cold War, and you were able to extract this. Now, how did you go about with your research?
Well, again, it came about quite by chance. In the 1980s, there was a very big sighting at a place called Voronezh, late 1980s, in the former Soviet Union, but purely by coincidence, I was interviewed by a number of Russian newspapers, and they just said my name and where I lived, and then the letters from Russia started dropping through my letterbox, most of them in Russian, and it was not just from researchers, it was from, you know, members like recounting their own experiences, their own sightings. I knew my colleague, Paul Stonehill. Paul is originally from the Ukraine, but now lives in California. Worked together with Paul translating some of this material. And Paul and I, at that point, were commissioned to write a small book called the Soviet UFO Files, which we did. But the material still kept coming through our letterbox, and we got to know most of the Russian UFO researchers. And we decided that, you know, the time was right to put this information into the public domain, simply because we hear very little, even today, from the former Soviet Union. Not so much now because of the restrictions. A lot of those have been relaxed. But, of course, the language barrier. It's very difficult to translate the information. And we were ideally placed. You know, information came into my office in the UK. It did so to Paul in California. And we're fortunate that Paul, you know, speaks and writes the language. So we thought it would be a great idea to translate as much as we could. There's even more than we've put in the book. It was, you know, it still comes into this very day. And Mysterious Sky is the end result. And it was to further emphasis, A, that the research has been conducted in the Soviet Union for a long, long time, but also to reinforce that whatever the UFO phenomena is, it certainly doesn't recognize any political borders, and the Soviet Union was no exception. So it was for a number of reasons, and also to give credit to the researchers there. I mean, you know, your listeners are probably aware of many researchers, certainly in the United States, well-known names, but I dare say very few of them have heard of anyone from the former Soviet Union.
Well,
to get them some recognition for their hard work, because, of course, at one point, under the old Soviet regime, quite literally, for getting involved in UFO research and studying it, it cost you your life.
Sure does. Philip, we're getting a crackling line from you, so I'm going to keep talking to you for the next 10 minutes or so until we get down to the half, and then I'm going to have Tom reconnect with you and hope that we get a better line, okay?
Okay.
Now, the KGB, were they involved in many of the then-Soviet cases?
Absolutely. I mean, the KGB and the Russian military conducted the biggest UFO study ever anywhere in the world. It all sparked with an incident that took place on the border between the Soviets and China. It was witnessed by many of their military personnel. And so the instructions went out that all Soviet military personnel, no matter where they were, from the lowest ranking officer, you know, the squaddy.
Sure.
The GI, you would call it. We call them squaddies. To the official military brass. Every single one of them were part of the project, and they had to report anything and everything they saw. And when you think of the Soviet military machine at the time, how many individual people were involved, and then it's the biggest UFO study ever conducted. And the KGB did go out and conduct interviews, mainly with the military and civilian population, more so the pilots and that kind of thing, but not exclusively. And after the fall of the Soviet Empire, of course, a lot of this material was released. It was actually a former Soviet pilot and cosmonaut who started the ball rolling and got some of the information released. And, of course, the KGB files, although we've only touched the surface, they are there. They have been translated into English, and they're in our book.
Tell us more about this Kola Peninsula area and what might have happened out there.
Well, there's one of the incidents there. I mean, it was a, you know, kind of a border. It's kind of a touchy area, like a lot of borders are. There's a lot of tension. Not a lot of activity, but a lot of looking at you and looking back and, you know, keep an eye on each other. And one evening, quite literally, a huge UFO, a glowing object, was observed at close quarters over the border. Not only was it observed at close quarters, it also affected the telecommunications of both sides, but mainly the Soviet side of things. Of course, it sent them into blind panic. You know, literally interfered with their communications. You know, they couldn't speak to each other, they couldn't speak back to the base and so on. And it was observed by certainly dozens, possibly even hundreds of individuals at the time. And it just sent the Russian military brass into absolute panic. What was this thing? And it could, you know, cut off all communications. They knew it wasn't theirs. They certainly knew it wasn't the Americans. And they certainly knew it wasn't the Chinese.
Sure. At least they hoped it wasn't ours, huh?
You know, so, you know, thought, well, we better try and find out what this is. And hence, you know, the investigation started in earnest. And they wanted to get to the bottom of it. I'm not sure they ever did, but they certainly tried.
Phil, is that the area where we've seen some film of Soviet soldiers kind of marching up to an object or a craft? Is that Kola area?
No, that's a completely different area. That was in the Ukraine. And our researchers largely dismissed that particular film as a fake.
Ah.
Unfortunately. You know, we're fortunate that we still have colleagues there in the Ukraine now who track this down. And a researcher in the US who, this came out as a part of a TV broadcast. He researched the television side of things. And unfortunately, you know, it came out as to be a fabrication. There was lots of loopholes in the film. Only, you know, someone from Russia would sort of see instantly there was problems with the Soviet military uniform and so on. But it's a fake, unfortunately. But it doesn't detract from the phenomena itself within the Soviet Union, because it goes back, you know, not just decades, but centuries. And not all of it, but a great deal of it is in mysterious sky.
Tell me about the Soviet scientists of the era. Were they involved in any of this, or were they hushed out?
No, well, they had to keep quiet But they weren't allowed to speak publicly for a long, long time. But yes, they were involved. And again, it's not hearsay. I was fortunate to have two bona fide Soviet scientists, both the Academy of Sciences in Moscow, come and stay at my house in England. One was Dr. Sergei Chanov. And the other chap, I'm not sure I can pronounce his name correctly, but it was Dr. Yuli Platov. For a living, they studied the ionosphere and the upper reaches of our atmosphere. That's what they did for a living. But they were involved in the UFO research program. They came to a conference in England. As far as I'm aware, they're the only Russian scientists ever to do that, and were allowed to speak for the first time. And they, you know, they told it a bit on the skeptical side that the phenomena exists, but, you know, regarding the nature and the origin of it. But no doubt that it does exist nonetheless. And they gave two fascinating lectures in the UK, detailing of how they'd gone about it, how they'd been involved. They even had a thing called an all-sky camera, where they could photograph a great deal of the sky. It was almost like a great fisheye lens that could take a huge photograph of the sky. And yes, they were involved. And, you know, they weren't allowed to speak for an awful long time. And then, of course, when the barriers came down, they were. Then the language barrier, but also the financial barrier prevented it as well. I mean, these were two gentlemen who both had PhDs, you know, but they were as poor as church mice. You know, if you or I had done the same kind of profession in our respective countries, we'd have had a steady and nice living.
Yeah, absolutely. did they ever have reversed engineered equipment that you know of? Craft?
It's rumored. These two particular scientists never talked about that kind of thing, but it's long been rumored by many of the researchers and the scientists. I mean, the Soviet Union has experienced just about everything you can think of, including crashes of vehicles. And whilst we've got no concrete proof of this, it is speculated that they do have material or materials that they have tried to understand. Whether you would call that reverse engineer, I'm not entirely sure. I think I would, but certainly try to get to the bottom of it. And of course, in some of the documentation that was released, we found out that the Soviet premier at the time, back in 1947, was interested in what happened at Roswell.
Many of us have heard about the 1908 blast over Tunguska in Siberia. Some 200 million trees over 850 square miles just flattened. Did you ever investigate that, Philip, or look into that?
Absolutely. I mean, Tunguska is mentioned in one chapter in the book. I mean, it's the biggest single blast of its kind ever to take place on Earth. And, I mean, I live several thousand miles from where the blast occurred. I'm in England. But we have a photograph. The nearest city to me, if anyone knows England, is called Leeds in West Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. We have a photograph of Leeds on that particular evening in 1908, and it's like daylight. So you could even see the blast from here. That's the kind of thing. Well, it's several thousand miles away.
My God, it's huge. Yeah. Well,
the main investigator was Professor Kulik. Or Kulig, I think, was the next commander. Didn't get there for a few years. What you have to understand about the region we're talking about in Tunguska is it's a swamp-infested nowhere. There were no roads. They didn't have a helicopter pad in 1908. It took them several years before they finally got there, and they were absolutely stunned. And they still go back, scientists still go back there every year now. And, of course, the evidence is still there for all to see.
Well, do you think it was an asteroid or something else?
There are a number of theories, and we've covered most of them in the book, but there are those that believe that it was a UFO that crashed, and not an asteroid or a planetary body or a meteorite. They've never found any material from planetary bodies or astronomical bodies that would explain this. I mean, whatever that was exploded at Tunguska didn't explode on impact. It exploded a certain distance above the Earth, pretty much like an atomic bomb does. You know, an atomic bomb does not explode on impact. And that's where you get the radial path of the trees in the blast area, because the blast came from above, not from ground level. And some of they literally had tribesmen living in that area at the time, almost nomad-like. They saw this thing coming into the atmosphere. And one of the peculiarities about it is that it seemed to change course.
Well, see, now that an asteroid would never do.
Exactly. it seemed to change course and then explode. And, you know, one of the theories to put forward, and it is only a theory, we can't prove it at all, is that it was, you know, not of this earth, and it was artificially made, to put it, you know, I can't put it any better than that. But it's a fascinating story in its own right. I mean, there's never been an impact on it like that in living history. And if you imagine that kind of explosion over one of the cities of the United States today, what the consequences would be.
It would wipe it out, Philip.
Absolutely.
There'd be nothing left.
Absolutely. And, you know, it would be totally devastating. It would
move. Millions of casualties. Let me ask you something. Is your cord loose on your phone?
It could well be.
That might be it, because you're really starting to crackle here. So we're going to see if we can, you and Tom can work something out there when we come back in just a couple minutes. Have there ever been reports of occupants on craft in any of these Soviet cases?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing that started all this, and you have to remember, back in 1987, there was an official press release by TASS, the official Soviet press agency, that reported the landing of a UFO in Voronezh, in Russia. And not only was it the landing, this was in daylight, it also reported its occupants that were outside it. And that was a story that went around the world. And it, the, you know, the location and the site were examined by the local scientists as well as UFO researchers, and that was an official TASS press release. And one of the Western journalists who went back to TASS and said, "Are you joking? Is this just you having a laugh?" And TASS, their reply was, "We don't joke." Typical Soviet fashion, yeah. You know, archetypical Soviet fashion, "We don't joke." And that's where I was then interviewed by the various Soviet newspapers that started all this. So not only do they have occupant reports, it was released by the official Soviet news agency.
And they're having abduction reports as we are in this country and as people are in the United Kingdom?
Absolutely. I mean, there's also there's the cultural difference, which seems to be the same no matter where you go in the world, slight differences in the way people perceive the encounters, just as there are in the U.S. But they certainly are there, no doubt about it at all.
Of every case you've investigated, every one about the Soviet Union, is there one that just stands out the most for you?
There's no one that stands out. I think certain incidents stand out, not because of their nature, but it's because of the people that's reported them. They're the kind of people who have the most to lose. And, of course, that's the Soviet cosmonauts. And, again, they were silenced for many, many years, but now they've gone on the record, pretty much as Buzz Aldrin did this year for the first time, of course, and say that the Apollo astronauts on the way to the first moon landing actually observed the UFO.
And then he kind of backed down a little bit. He was a guest on my show, Philip, and he basically said, "Nah, nothing really has happened." And but I don't know. There are two conflicting stories there. But with these cosmonauts, what are some of the things they said?
Well, I mean, they've been quite candid. And again, I was fortunate enough to meet one of the Soviet cosmonauts in the Republic of San Marino in Italy at a conference, and they've made it quite clear that, whilst in space, usually on the Mir or one of the space stations, they have observed, you know, artifacts that are not of this Earth, and they certainly weren't, you know, certainly weren't American. And they've described them as large cylinders, illuminated. They've even taken some pictures of them. I haven't seen those pictures, but they have taken them. And I mean, the cosmonaut I met was a hero of the Soviet Union with his medals and so on. He was on Mir. And it makes no doubt about it. They have seen things that they can't explain.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back, Philip. We're going to check your lines. Tom will be picking you up right there. And if we can get it fixed, we'll continue. If not, I might have to do open lines. So we'll be back in a moment. Let's hope it works. He's a great guest. Well, we think we may have got the old phone fixed. I don't think it's the line problem. So we switch some phones out there in the United Kingdom with Philip, and let's hope that holds up. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And let's go back to Philip Mantle. Philip, let's continue talking about the cosmonauts and some of the things that they saw up there in space.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reports we have is actually from the Mir space station, and it was the cosmonauts, and they have to excuse me, I cannot pronounce their names. I have trouble with English, never mind Russian.
But you know what? Nobody will know anyway.
Well, they were en route, quite literally, to dock with the Mir. And it was a peculiar-looking thing, but it had antenna and protrusions, they call it, but it certainly looked like antenna, certainly under its own control, certainly not of Soviet design. And it was illuminated. It had lights, and it appeared to be shadowing them, for want of a better word, certainly moving in tandem with them, in parallel with them. And they were absolutely perplexed by this thing. They were the top of the tree as far as certainly orbital spacecraft were at the time, and that's no disrespect to the US. And they reported it accordingly. And it was only after the fall of the Soviet authorities, the Soviet Empire, if you like, that the cosmonauts then started to speak up. And it was mainly because one of the cosmonauts called... came out and became interested in the subject. She was able to persuade others. And, the floodgates didn't exactly open, but they certainly began to leak. And the information slowly but surely came out. And whilst not all of them have gone on the record, and I think that's the same in the United States, certainly a number of them have, as well as, high-ranking military officials, not just the cosmonauts as well. And it's fascinating to hear it because, excuse me, when people ridicule the UFO subject, it's people like the cosmonauts. They have the most to lose by reporting this kind of thing. And so for them to go onto the record, they must believe in it themselves. And they've more to lose than the ordinary Joe in the street, and that's no disrespect. But it makes for fascinating reading. It really does. And it's very, very difficult to dismiss. I mean, we all know that a lot of UFO sightings can be easily explained,
Right.
Balloons, planets, that kind of thing. But this is in space. A 747 doesn't go past you with its landing lights on in the fog and then you make a mistake.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. And when people like that start to report this kind of thing, then you got to sit up and take notice. You really have.
Did you get any reports or did you investigate the incredible story of a UFO over Chernobyl when that event was occurring?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole point of Mysterious Sky, we look at the UFO phenomenon right back from prehistory almost, right the way up to modern-day Russia. And there were reports over Chernobyl on and around and afterwards when the disaster took place, mostly seen by the local population there at the time, but certainly strange lights, strange objects seen at the time, and also even more up to date when we have the war in Chechnya. We talk about the UFO sightings over the Chechen battlefields that again have been reported by both civilian and military witnesses. But yes, there certainly were reports that came our way from on and around the time and afterwards of the Chernobyl disaster. Now, whether it was something keeping an eye on it, whether it was something to do with the panic at the time or whether it was an after effect of the disaster, no one can be really sure. But there were certainly reports there without a question of a doubt.
Did any of them ever talk about or were they concerned about the visitations? Did they feel threatened at all?
No, I don't think there's ever been a direct threat. I mean, that's what the military were concerned about, of course. Was this a threat? Was it and I'll use this in the right context, was it a foreign technology that was, intending them harm? I mean, we do know a lot of the power behind the Soviet Empire was built on paranoia and scare tactics and this kind of thing. But the reports that have come our way, there was never, ever any direct threat, either implied or assumed by any of this phenomena. It was more that it was just there for whatever reason, didn't seem to be doing any harm, didn't seem to be hurting anyone or anything, apart from, the Tunguska blast, that is. But it certainly wasn't a malevolent force at all. I mean, again, like the US, like different places around the world, there are parts of the Soviet Union, we still call it that for want of a better phrase, that seem to have a concentration of sightings. there seems to be a lot in one particular area down the years. And the locals that live there and who observe this phenomenon have sort of become accustomed to it. You know, it's not going to hurt them. It's not killing their, you know, their livestock. It's not doing any harm. It is just there. And as puzzling and sometimes frightening as it may seem, if you come upon it unexpectedly, like most people do, it actually doesn't do you any harm, and it doesn't appear to be. And it, you know, if you look around the world at some of the areas that have the strange lights, they have them in Martha in Texas, for example. They also take on their own name. The locals tend to give them their own names as well. I mean, the Aborigines in Australia, for example, call them the Min Min lights. So, but they don't do them any harm. So they certainly weren't there. You know, nothing malevolent at all.
Do you know if the Soviets were working in tandem with the United States government or even the British government as a joint effort on some of these cases?
Can't find any information that would support that at all, George. Mm. I mean, none whatsoever. I mean, you have to remember that mostly at the time, this was, you know, a closed society. It took you great difficulty to even get out of the country on holiday or on vacation or whatever. And certainly no cooperation with any other agencies outside of the Soviet Union. It was purely, you know, insular. It was all done mainly by the KGB and the military, a lot of the investigation. There were the civilian researchers tried to cooperate as best as they could, and a lot of this was underground. Certainly in the 60s and the 70s, they called it, you know, the Invisible College. There were a few scientists, mainly Dr. Felix Siegel, trying to get his work out into, you know, the Western world. And a little bit of it did filter out, you know, now and again, but by no means to any great degree. And it was only really after the fall of the Soviet Empire that we could learn more about what happened there from all sources. But on an official basis, I'm not saying it didn't happen. All I'm saying is at the moment we haven't discovered that. But the files of the ministries there and the KGB are enormous. And who knows what may turn up in the future.
Were there ever any reports of government leaders talking with any of these inhabitants of these craft or anything? Like we always hear, you know, Area 51 here in the United States, we hear all kinds of bizarre things. Did you get anything like that?
Not really, no. But we know that some of the Soviet leaders were interested. Joseph Stalin. Back in 1947, for example, it is known, officially known, that he wanted to find out what had happened at Roswell, because the Roswell crash, you know, the press release went around the world, but I don't think he ever found out. But he certainly was interested; he wanted to know. As did at the same time over in the UK, it made the headlines here. And just a few years later, our Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, wanted to know what all this stuff about UFOs was. That's in an official memo, you know, anyone can get access to. So it's not rumour. They were certainly interested. But whether they were ever took it any further than that or partook in this type of phenomena still remains to be seen. Again, it's because of the closed nature of the society. And, you know, sticking your nose in those days and asking questions like that could quite literally mean you're off to the gulag or you just disappeared and never to return.
Why have these governments been so successful, Philip, in withholding the information, at least covering it up so that we, as people, could never find out what was going on?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people have often asked me, is there a cover-up? And I would have to say yes, there is. I mean, it's easy to prove. Cover-up means the withholding of information for whatever purpose. And it's easily provable. I mean, colleagues of mine in the UK, for example, have only found out in these last few years that we had a secret department back in the 1950s, you know, the UFO Working Party, as I believe, or the Flying Saucer Working Party, it was called at that time, that, you know, down in Whitehall in London, studying UFOs officially. You know, this weren't a bunch of clerks who did it in their spare time. This wasn't officially. Again, it had been rumoured on and off, but there was no proof. Now, it's only up until these last couple of years that we didn't have the Freedom of Information Act. We did not have one. And when that was released, of course, this information then, you know, started to leak out. And so why they keep it secret, I don't know. I mean, the obvious thing is that we are being visited by extraterrestrials, and they don't want the population to know, for whatever reason, for political and social reasons, I mean a whole host of reasons. It could well be that the powers that be, including ours and the US and the Soviet Union, are as baffled as the rest of us by the UFO phenomenon, and no major power would ever want to admit that they don't know what's flying around in their skies, that they don't not control their own airspace. Or it could just be red tape. The nature of government is red tape, and things do get covered. I mean, it's the Official Secrets Act in the UK, that's what we have. It covers all things supposedly secret. And it's an official secret, for example, this is how ridiculous it goes, to know how many tea bags they use in the House of Commons in Parliament. That's how ridiculous it is. But that is just red tape. I mean, a friend of mine signed the Official Secrets Act because he worked in a textile mill. And they used to make the textiles for the dress uniforms in the military. But he still had to sign the Official Secrets Act. He worked in a textile mill, for heaven's sake. You know, so that's how far-reaching it is. It's ludicrous.
Let's go back to the beginning of what you were able to uncover in terms of visitations over the Soviet Union, Russia. How far back? Thousands of years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, because of the country it is, it has, and this is not, again, no disrespect to the United States, the US, we still look in terms of being a new country. You know, it is the new country.
Of course.
The new world. But certainly in Europe and the Soviet Union is no different. You know, the population, they go back, you know, centuries. And in the folklore of the country and the ancient manuscripts, the visitations, the sightings, the UFOs go back right through history. It's not a modern phenomenon. Whatever the UFO phenomena is, George, it certainly didn't sort of spring to life with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947. Although we put that as the modern era of the subject, of course. But it certainly goes back through history, and with recordings, because of the type of country that Russia was and became, they were ruled by the Tsars, you know, the ruling royal family. Of course, they go back many decades. So, you know, documents and historical records were kept, and stories were written in various languages and books and manuscripts. And they are there. Again, it was mainly the language barrier that prevented a lot of this coming to the surface, but it's there. And there are UFO sightings and encounters with otherworldly beings going back centuries, and it's certainly not a modern phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination.
Did they ever theorize that they might have thought that humans were genetically altered? Were there any reports written in old Russian manuscripts or texts or anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, they almost echo the biblical story of Adam and Eve. One gentleman said to me, you know, to him, Adam and Eve looks like a genetic experiment. You know,
take a piece
of one person and you make another one. It was cloning, if want of a better word, but you didn't make a replica, you made another person. And there are this kind of stories, again, in the old folklore texts throughout the Soviet Union of this. And also the type of beings that were radically different in certainly in appearance to the Soviets at the time. And, you know, the fair-skinned, you know, pretty-looking, fair-haired people, which not just in that particular area, but throughout Russia and Scandinavia. We give them the nickname of the Nordics, of course. Absolutely, no question about that at all.
Did the reports of the craft change at all over the years? Or did they stay the same? The kinds of craft that were out there?
I think they've only changed in modern times, to be honest, George. They were pretty standard. They were pretty much the same as you know, have been reported throughout history here. You know, the discs or the shields or the glowing lights or the tubes or cigar shapes. They were, you know, the pattern is there just because it was the Soviet Union. As we said right at the beginning, whatever the UFO subject is, it certainly doesn't take any notice of international borders. And that was, you know, the Soviet Union was no different whatsoever, be it today or be it 500 years ago. And, you know, the cylinders, the shiny wheels in the sky, all this kind of thing.
Tell me a little bit about Plekskin and what we know about this individual.
So that, I didn't quite catch the name then.
Was it the Plekskin? What is that?
I don't recognize the name.
Plekskin? It says A. Plekskin. Said something about secret Soviets and they're trying to hide some programs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I didn't recognize the name because there's lots of them in the Soviet Union.
Right. No, I understand.
It was great putting that manuscript through the spell checker, I can assure you.
And I might not even be pronouncing his name right.
But, yeah, I mean, again, it's rumored, I think I hear on one of your intros, like, you know, Area 51 in the U.S., it's rumored that in parts of certainly modern-day Russia, they have their own equivalent of Area 51. Perhaps not on as large a scale, perhaps not as big or anything of that nature, but it's certainly there. And I met a chap in America, although he's from Russia, just 3 years ago, and he made it quite clear that they, as far as he's concerned, he's a Russian. He claims to work for the Russian government now. It's a claim that's disputed, but he showed his documents that they have a facility there that's not too dissimilar to Area 51, but not, like I said, not as large. And pretty much the same kind of thing takes place, that they have captured alien technology, for want of a better phrase, and that a number of individuals, you know, scientists, Soviet scientists, Russian scientists, working there. And I don't know if your listeners remember a colleague of mine who sadly died just a couple of years ago, and almost 3 years ago, a chap by the name of Graham Birdsall. Graham used to run and edit UFO magazine in the UK. And Graham was all set, was in negotiations with this particular chap to go to Russia to see this site, to visit it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, sadly, Graham died, you know, very unexpectedly.
Oh, sad.
And, you know, so the invitation, I mean, I was there when the invitation was made. Graham interviewed this chap and published the interview in UFO magazine detailing this particular location, and he was set to go. So, again, you know, the rumour is there. I have no doubt that the actual, you know, facility exists now. Whether it's got these experiments being conducted there is a different argument. But it would certainly be an interest. I mean, Graham was a great big bluff man. I'm sure he would have made himself known when he got there, one way or another. But we'll have to wait and see. We will have to wait and see. You know, more research is ongoing as we speak.
You know, some say that the Germans had UFO technology. That's why they were so ahead at the time during World War II. We were fortunate enough to, you know, have the ability to beat them. But that they had this ability and that their scientists were working on it. And that's why, of course, the Soviets at the time and us both benefited with the German scientists for our own individual space programs.
Absolutely. I mean, Operation Paperclip. I mean, after the war, you know, the spoils of war were many and varied. But one of those spoils was the German scientists. We know Wernher von Braun went to the U.S., but the Soviets got their pick as well of the German scientists.
And I'm sure they got good ones too, right?
Yeah, I don't think they treated them as well as perhaps the Americans did, but they certainly took them. And yeah, I mean, there's two rumors here that you can work on. Is one, that the technology we see was purely and invented by the German scientists, nothing else. It was their technology that they worked on over the years.
Which is possible.
Or B, that the technology was not theirs, but they'd got it from elsewhere, i.e. from extraterrestrials, one way or another, but they had adapted it, reverse engineered it, or were trying to do that, hadn't quite succeeded, and of course the war ended and the US and the Soviet took over where the Germans left off, taking the scientists with them, of course, who had worked on it. And I tried to track a chap down here in the UK, I mean, in the country of Wales here. It's known as the valleys. There's lots of small little valleys and little rural areas. And he was from Poland. He was a Polish immigrant who had settled here after the war. And he claimed to have worked at one of these establishments making a flying saucer.
Let's see what
for
he
the
says
Germans.
When we come back, Philip. I'll ask you about him.